From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!, broadcasting from Boston, Massachusetts.
In order to understand the really disastrous place we are today, you have to look back at the whole history of the Pentagon. A momentum has been generated in the center of this building toward unnecessary war, toward dependence on nuclear weapons, and toward a real blindness to what really is happening in the world.
House of War. Today, James Carroll, one of Boston's best-known writers on the Pentagon and the disastrous rise of American power. But first, hundreds of students joined scores of faculty members to oppose a decision by Boston College to invite Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice to speak at graduation and receive an honorary degree. And Brandeis University takes down a Palestinian youth art exhibit that was mounted by an Israeli Jewish student. We'll speak with the student as well as the director of Brandeis's Ethics and Justice Center. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Capitol Hill, House and Senate Republicans have agreed on a new tax bill critics say will disproportionately favor the wealthiest Americans. The $70 billion measure would extend the 15% tax rate on capital and dividends until the year 2010. According to the Tax Policy Center, households earning more than $1 million would save $42,000 in taxes. Meanwhile, households earning around $45,000 would save $46. Meanwhile, Housing and Urban Development Department Secretary Alfonso Jackson's coming under scrutiny after he revealed he canceled a proposed deal with a government contractor because of critical comments of President Bush. According to the Dallas Business Journal, Jackson said the contractor had selected for a government advertising contract, but he was ultimately not selected after he told Jackson he didn't like President Bush. Jackson said, quote, "Why should I reward someone who doesn't like the president so they can use funds to try to campaign against the president? Logic says they don't get the contract. That's the way I believe," he said. In response, Democratic Congressmembers Barney Frank of Massachusetts and Henry Waxman of California called for a full investigation of Jackson's contract decisions. In a letter to Jackson, the congressmembers wrote, quote, "If this account is accurate, your comments and actions were improper and most likely illegal. Federal contracts should be awarded based on merit, not on whether a contractor likes or dislikes President Bush," they wrote. At the United Nations, the General Assembly elected 44 countries to the newly created Human Rights Council. The council was created in March to replace the much-criticized UN Human Rights Commission. The U.S. government took itself out of the running in protest of what it said were the council's low standards. 22 U.S. citizens have traveled to Iran to promote peace between Washington and Tehran. Stanley Campbell, a member of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, spoke shortly after the group's arrival on Tuesday.
It's wonderful to be here. Thank you very much for welcoming us here. I hope and pray that that America and Iran can be friends forever. There's many people who do not understand what's going on, and many of us that are coming and visiting will be sharing our thoughts and impressions with our friends back home. And we hope they will be your friends, too, as well.
Stanley Campbell, a member of the Fellowship of Reconciliation delegation to Tehran. In India, hundreds of people took to the streets today to protest a U.S. drug company's attempt to patent a popular drug used by millions of people to treat HIV. The company, Gilead Science, wants the Indian government to recognize its patent claim to the antiretroviral drug TDF. Activists say the patent will make drugs like TDF inaccessible to thousands of people who could only afford a generic version. This is Hans van der Weerd of Doctors Without Borders.
We want that this patent, this application, will be rejected. Otherwise, it will be a very, very important big problem worldwide, because a lot of people, millions of people, they will not be able to buy those drugs. And those drugs are really very important to survive.
That was Hans van der Weerd of Doctors Without Borders. The quartet of Middle East peace brokers has reached a temporary agreement to resume aid to the Palestinians that's been frozen under the Hamas-led government. The United Nations, the United States, Russia, and the European Union made the announcement on Tuesday. This is UN Secretary General Kofi Annan.
The quartet underscored its continued commitment to a two-state solution as embodied in the roadmap, as well as the need for both parties to avoid actions which could prejudice final status issues. We reiterated our grave concern that the Palestinian Authority government has so far failed to commit itself to the principles of nonviolence, recognition of Israel, and acceptance of previous agreements and obligations, including the roadmap. The quartet expressed concern.
This news from Iraq: at least 17 people were killed and 35 wounded when a suicide bomber struck a crowded market in Tal Afar. In Peru, thousands of people marched Tuesday to demand Yale University return artifacts taken from an ancient city nearly a century ago. A Yale historian took the artifacts from the city of Machu Picchu in 1911. Yale's refused the Peruvian government's demand for the artifacts' return, saying it was given ownership rights during the excavations. The artifacts remain on display at Yale. In other news, a Yale historian says he's uncovered a letter that supports the theory that Yale Skull and Bone Society stole the skull of Native American leader Geronimo. According to the legend, Skull and Bones members, including Prescott Bush, the president's grandfather, dug up Geronimo's remains from his burial plot in Fort Sill, Oklahoma. The letter, written by a Skull and Bones member in 1918, says group members took skull and other remains and buried them in their Yale clubhouse. In Nevada, a controversial bomb test that's drawn the opposition of local Native groups has been delayed at least 3 weeks. Members of the Western Shoshone filed suit last month to prevent the military from setting off a 700-ton ammonium nitrate and fuel oil bomb that would generate a mushroom cloud over the Nevada deserts. Tribe members say the blast could let loose radioactive material and threaten their well-being. President Bush's approval rating has reached a new low. 31%. That figure matches the lowest rating of the presidency of his father, George H.W. Bush, and is the third lowest approval rating of any president in half a century. And the Yes Men have struck again. On Tuesday, a man claiming to be a representative for the company Halliburton gave a presentation at the Catastrophic Loss Conference at the Ritz-Carlton in Amelia Island, Florida. The conference included leaders from the insurance industry. The phony spokesperson gave his name as Fred Wolf. He told conference-goers Halliburton had invented the Survivaball, a new orb-like inflatable product to protect corporate managers from the effects of global warming. Wolf said, quote, "It's essentially a gated community for one." The hoax comes less than 2 years after a Yes Men member appeared on the BBC claiming to be a spokesperson for Dow Chemical. He said Dow was taking responsibility for the Bhopal chemical disaster, forcing the company to remind the world it did not take responsibility for the disaster and that there was no compensation fund set up for the victims. Brandeis is our top story today. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, and we are broadcasting from Boston, Massachusetts. We're starting by looking at a controversy that's erupted over an art exhibit at Brandeis University in Boston. The exhibition features 17 paintings of Palestinian youths who depict their perspectives of life under the Israeli military occupation. But just 4 days into the two-week run, the exhibit was removed by Brandeis officials after several complaints from students. A Brandeis spokesperson has said the school would consider remounting the paintings if they appear alongside paintings showing an Israeli perspective. The exhibition was curated by an Israeli Jewish student who said she wanted to showcase a Palestinian perspective on campus. The exhibit was subsequently removed to MIT, where it's now on display for a week. We're joined on the telephone from Waltham, where Brandeis University is, by Lior Halperin. She's the student who organized the exhibit at the university. We're also joined in the studio by Daniel Terrace. He is the director of Brandeis University's International Center for Ethics, Justice, and Public Life. Lior's exhibit was a project for a class called The Arts of Building Peace, which is taught under the auspices of the center. Lior Halperin is an Israeli Jewish student at Brandeis who organized the exhibit. We welcome you, Lior, as well as Daniel Terrace, to this broadcast. Lior Halperin, we'd like to begin with you. Can you explain how you came to mount this exhibit at Brandeis?
Hi, good morning.
It's good to have you with us.
As you explained, I took a class called The Arts of Building Peace this semester, and we were trying to find the ways in which arts can be used as a mechanism for bringing people together, for enhancing debate, for conflict resolution and reconciliation. And since I believe in all of that deeply, and since I'm an Israeli and a peace activist, I thought about bringing my usage of art and my belief of art as a mechanism for bringing people together into the Brandeis community. And my connection to Palestinian children has been in the past through using art to express their belief and their opinions. This was my objective for bringing the exhibition on campus. I contacted a dear friend of mine that is a director of the El Ruad Cultural Center in Ada refugee camp in Bethlehem. And together we came up with the concept of having this exhibition brought to Brandeis, where I felt in my only year in Brandeis that the Palestinian voice has been very marginalized and not as freely expressed and prevalent like as the Israeli point of view is on campus. And he contacted the children from the center and asked them a very simple question to create paintings of images of their lives, which they did. And that was my exhibition, their exhibition.
How old are the kids?
Between 11 and 16.
And the number of paintings?
17.
And Daniel Terrace, can you talk about Brandeis University's decision to take down the paintings?
Good morning. Good morning, Amy, and good morning, Lior. Let me talk about the lens through which I looked at the exhibit. Over the last several years, Brandeis has been really deeply involved in trying to bring a more complex perspective to the Middle East and to really pursue a kind of goal of mutual understanding. My center has been deeply involved in not only bringing Israeli viewpoints to campus, but really making a sustained effort to bring Palestinian voices to Brandeis. We have actively recruited students, Arab students from all over the Middle East. We've established partnerships through my center with NGOs in Ramallah, in East Jerusalem, in Nablus, and in Bethlehem. And we've also put together a multi-year, multi-dimensional partnership between Brandeis University and Al-Quds University, one of the premier Palestinian universities. So I've been deeply involved in those efforts. And one of the things I've learned in the whole series of programs that we've done on the Middle East, many of which have brought Palestinian voices to campus, even during this year when Lior says they've been silenced or marginalized, is that these kind of things need to be done with great care. There's a lot of sensitivity on every side, both in the Jewish community, in the Palestinian community, and in the American community over these issues. So that any activity that we undertake needs to be done with great care, not only to offend people, because that's not necessarily the issue, but to do something so that the educational context is maximized and so the goal of mutual understanding is pursued. Lior's exhibit, while done with the best of intention, is really nurtured in the very climate in which Palestinian voices are welcomed onto campus. Had the admirable goal of trying to humanize Palestinian youth. But I was concerned that the form and the content of the exhibit actually in some ways undermined the goal that she was trying to pursue. So I called to advise her that I thought the exhibit was in some ways not reaching the goals that she really wanted to achieve.
And was it your decision to take down the exhibit?
I wasn't involved in the decision to take down the exhibit. What I did was suggest to Lior that there were ways in which this exhibit, while with the intent of humanizing Palestinian children and Palestinian youth and giving them voice, in some ways actually contributed to the opposite kind of perception. The combination of paintings with political speech, the controversial images that were part of the exhibit, and the absolute lack of any educational context so that viewers who came in and went by the exhibit in a library space had no real opportunity for understanding might have contributed to the opposite effect that Lior intended. And this was kind of confirmed when some of the Brandeis students who went by the exhibit the couple of days after it was over called the administration and said, why is this exhibit intended to show how Palestinian young people are propagandized by their elders? And so that was the kind of concern I had, that actually the form and content of the exhibit had the opposite effect that Lior was trying to achieve.
Lior Halperin, your response.
Well, I agree with almost everything that Danielle Terry says. My only question is, was the decision to take it down the right decision if the intent was to allow an educational debate to take place? Because if anything, the debate that is going on right now between the Brandeis community that has been amazingly supportive proves that the university community is ready to discuss those issues and is ready to see those images. And it's a community that refuses to have a decision taken by the administration for it, saying that it's not ready to deal with those images portrayed in the paintings of the children.
I think everybody on the Brandeis campus agrees that we need a better process for thinking about how to host controversial speech on campus. I think it's clear that we need a better advanced process where an exhibit like Lior's, instead of just kind of through a bureaucratic method going up on the library, has some kind of advanced preparation in which faculty and students and administrators are all involved in thinking, what's the right context? What are the right kinds of events that stimulate conversation? What are the ways in which we can maximize the educational opportunities?
Daniel Terrace, what were the images you most objected to of the kids' drawings?
Well, it wasn't any particular image. It was the way that the whole exhibit was framed and the fact that there wasn't really much explanation about how the images were chosen, how the speech and the images were put together. And that there wasn't really much opportunity for real public conversation and expression around the exhibit. So it was the combination of all those things, not the fact that any particular image was controversial or difficult. I mean, we've sponsored dozens of programs on campus that have had, where people have said controversial things from all different perspectives. So that isn't the issue. The issue is how it's held, how the conversation is promoted on campus.
Lior Halperin.
Yeah. Let me say that a week before the exhibition opened, I did an enormous outreach to the Brandeis community. I wrote emails and phone calls to almost every activist group on campus, including a lot of professors and faculty, asking them to please attend the exhibition opening that we had on the 26th of April, telling them that this is going to be a controversial issue and a difficult issue for many people in the Brandeis community, and I'm asking them to come and create a dialogue and debate. I got no response from the community. I got no response from the community. Also, alongside the paintings, there was my narrative, my statement as a curator of the exhibition, explaining that as an Israeli and a peace activist, I believe in the power of the art to bring people together and my ability to empathize and understand the paintings that are coming from Palestine is what I believe the core of our ability to create coexistence and reconciliation in that complex area. So, I also know that there were students who complained for a very specific number of paintings that were very difficult for them. But my question is, how would we expect Palestinian children from refugee camps to portray anything else but the reality of their lives? If it's difficult to see in the third floor of a beautiful library in Waltham, we can imagine what it means to live those daily lives, which is exactly the intent of my exhibition. It was taken down because I think people could not allow themselves to respect those images in a respectful way. I don't think the intent of taking down the exhibition was to create a better forum for it to be taken back. I think the intent was to take it down, to continue silencing those voices.
Well, during the week that the exhibit controversy was going on campus, I was hosting 8 prominent Palestinian administrators from Al-Quds University who were meeting with people from all over campus, speaking on campus, learning both about administration in order to build partnerships between Brandeis and Al-Quds, and also speaking about larger issues on the Middle East. And this has followed a whole series of other visits by people from Al-Quds University, as well as the appointment of a prominent Palestinian to our Crown Center of Middle East Studies, as well as a series of other programs that have presented a variety of views on the Middle East. So I really don't think this is about silencing Palestinian voices. This isn't to say it was the right or wrong decision to take down the exhibit, but I do think the question of care, the question of genuine collaboration between faculty and students and administrators about how to do each of these programs best is really at the core, and I think Brandeis will look forward and look for ways to do this kind of thing better over the months to come.
Are you sorry Brandeis has taken made the decision it did to remove the exhibit?
I think I really regret that the exhibit has become the center of this kind of controversy, and I think everybody agrees that the process that we had in place was not a good process, either for mounting this, because Lior mounted the exhibit without any real kind of genuine discussion, and I think everybody agrees that we didn't have a good process for considering it once it was in place. So I think that's the kind of thing we're going to try to fix.
I was with some people from MIT, a professor, last night, and I asked about the art exhibit because it's on display now at MIT. And he was saying there's absolutely no controversy about it. It's hardly gotten any attention, actually, by it being up.
Well, the context has been well established by the public controversy that there's been, and it may not be the same kind of issue on their campus.
Who were the people that objected? Students, donors, who?
Well, I certainly saw some complaints from students. I don't know whether there were complaints from donors or others outside the university, but the complaints I saw were from students. But I want to say that my phone call to Lior was not prompted by student complaints, although it was somewhat exacerbated by the fact that students were confirming the doubts that I had had about the exhibit.
Looking at some of the articles on the whole controversy, the Daily News Tribune, an article called Facing Censorship, it talks about students carrying signs outside the library to criticize what they say is censorship by the university. And then it says Alice Rothschild of Boston, a member of Jewish Voice for Peace, carried a sign that said, "Closing our eyes to injustice is not a Jewish value." Your response?
I think trying to create a full-bodied picture of all points of view, bringing them to campus, discussing them, having them as an integral part of our community is absolutely a Jewish value. It's absolutely a Brandeis University value. And I think we're going to continue to do that kind of work in the months and years to come.
Lior Halpern, the response of the community, you were saying they didn't respond to your original call to come out for the opening of the exhibit, but once the paintings were taken down.
Yes, and I think it's a combination of people being outraged that the university has decided for them they're unable or not mature enough to respect those images. So it's a combination of people going out for the freedom of expression, freedom of speech, and people who are for freedom of Palestine and freedom of the art. But I think the outreach has been truly amazing. If anything, the debate is taking place right now. I bless for that. I disagree with Mr. Terris that it's the discussion that has followed taking down the exhibition is not useful. I think it's an intelligent and civilized and wonderful discussion that is taking place right now, and I absolutely bless for that. I received the most enormous amount of support from people, from professors, from students, from faculty, from people within the larger community of Boston, saying that they blessed for my initiative and they see the beauty in what I was trying to bring on campus to show the human connectedness between people who are different. And even though they live in a conflict area, they're able to create this connection.
Amy, I want to say I think the debate going forward is indeed healthy in many ways. And I think one of the things we need to do is coming out of this is to remember that there is an inherent tension on university campuses today between academic freedom and freedom of expression. And I've gotten a lot of emails and communications saying this is simply a pure case of academic freedom. But academic freedom is not an absolute in a context in which universities have an interest in thinking about the educational fabric of the community and in thinking about how to contain and hold speech in a way that is productive and that doesn't incite issues of hatred and violence. Now, I'm not saying that in this particular case, that was the issue and that these young children were advocating hatred and violence. I'm only saying that this is an issue, a tension, that universities have been dealing with for a long time in this country and are going to continue to, and the debate that comes out of this will help us deal with it better.
Do you see the exhibit being mounted again?
There's certainly talk about that on the Brandeis campus. The administration has invited some faculty to begin considering ways in which it could be brought back, but in a way that's fully productive.
Lior Halpern, would you consider mounting it again?
I will definitely consider mounting it again. I have yet to receive any response from the university administration directly. They're still not considering me a part of this equation. So until they do and explain to me in a respectful and intelligent manner why was the exhibition taken down, what was so intimidating about these images, and what would be a good way, they would think, to bring it back, and why do they want to bring it back on campus, I don't feel I can bring back the paintings of the children. These are paintings by children, not by me. And I respect their opinion and their decision. So it's a decision of me and them together.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. I want to thank Daniel Terrace, director of Brandeis University's International Center for Ethics, Justice, and Public Life, and Lior Halpern, an Israeli Jewish student at Brandeis University, who organized the Palestinian Youth Art exhibit that the university took down. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We are broadcasting from Boston, and we'll have another debate from another college, Boston College, about its decision to honor Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. We'll also speak with well-known Boston writer James Carroll. Stay with us.
شهيد والألم من الصميم ما عاد فينا نتحمل عهالظلم يا عالم الصبر لربك التحكيم على أرواحهم لنقرأ بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم 13 شهيد أفر الدمع دليل على القبر لساته عم بيسيل أخذته الكثير دمع اللي سال على دمه اللي سال قال استخسرته فينا ليش حتى الأقل من القليل 13 شهيد ايه ما صعب الفراق مو العين ما بتكفي بكى وأنين ما بفيد 13 شهيد ايه ما أقوى الاشتياق وجع بزيد كيف قطعتوا الدم عن الوريد موطني 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 الشباب لن يكل همه أن تستقل أو يبيد أو يبيد نستقي من الردى ولن نكون للعداء كالعبيد كالعبيد جينا لنحكي القصة ودمعي بعيني لسه قالوا لي إيش يا خاين الخاين اللي بينسى كيف صار وقلبك يقصى تمشي وتنسى القصة تنسى الماضي اللي كاين والخوف بقلبك يرسى كيف ننسى دم اللي راح ما راح خليته طالع من بيته على الراي وطالع يعبر خليته لكنا يا ريتو يا ريتو سجين ما بيتحرر لو متنا حنضل نكرر ما بينفع معنا سلاح يعني حاولت تقول لا وشوي رفعت الصوت بالكوي واجهونا برصاص يقتلونا يا السجن يا الموت والعرب يا ربي شو خطر كل هذا لانه حامل حجر واليهودي لو حامل صخر دم العربي برضه بينهضر وانا بستغرب كيف تستغرب انه احنا وصلنا على الوضع 50 سنه واحنا ساكتين ومخبيين جواتنا الوجع صرنا زي القنبله الزمنيه كل هذا لانه اقليه لا مش بس اقليه اقليه دول اسرائيليه
The Palestinian rap group Dam here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting on over 420 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM college and community radio stations, as well as public access TV and PBS stations, and both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we are video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. As we turn now here in Boston to our next guest, James Carroll, one of Boston's best-known writers. A decade ago, he won the National Book Award for his memoir, An American Requiem, God, My Father, and the War That Came Between Us. James Carroll is also a prize-winning columnist for the Boston Globe. He's just published a new book now called House of War, The Pentagon, and the Disastrous Rise of American Power. In the book, Carroll examines the growth of the military-industrial complex since World War II and his personal connection to the Pentagon. That's the building, the Pentagon. He grew up in a military family. His father was a three-star general and the first director of the Defense Intelligence Agency. He oversaw the agency throughout much of the Vietnam War. But James Carroll took a different path, becoming a vocal opponent of the war, as well as a writer. For the past 6 years, he's been researching the history of the Pentagon and what he calls the, quote, disastrous rise of American power. James Carroll joins us now
in our studio in Boston. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy. Good to be here.
It's good to have you with us. You begin the book by talking about the actual physical building of the Pentagon that you grew up in as a child.
My dad used to take me there on Saturdays. I remember the thrill it was to take my shoes off and slide down the big, broad ramps in my stocking feet. There was a way in which it was the first place I actually experienced away from home as something monumental, belonging to me. The truth is, I remembered that early feeling for the place on 9/11 when it was hit. I was shocked by the grief I felt, the grief America felt, mostly focused on the World Trade Center, in my case, was surprisingly focused on the Pentagon.
Can you talk about the history of the building?
I begin this work looking at the week it was dedicated, a week in January 1943. Four things happened that week, generating a momentum that we're still at the mercy of, I argue. One, at Casablanca, Franklin Roosevelt, really against the wishes of his partner Winston Churchill, announced a new policy of unconditional surrender. The Axis powers had to unconditionally surrender to the Allies, a position that really would have disastrous consequences, especially in Japan, in the late months of the war. The second thing that happened that week was Los Alamos really was up and running. Began to be up and running. The Manhattan Project had been initiated the previous autumn, but it really began right then. The third thing that happened that week, Churchill and Roosevelt together agreed on a joint bomber offensive between the RAF and the Army Air Forces of the United States. It was the beginning of the American embrace of strategic bombing as a mode of war. The first bombing attack by the Americans against a German city took place 2 weeks later. So strategic bombing, nuclear weapons, a spirit of total war embodied in unconditional surrender, all joined to the other thing that happened that week, the beginning of the building, this mass bureaucracy, which itself then would take on a kind of life that was beyond the ability of any one person or group of persons to check it. And the momentum that began that week really has flowed on essentially unchecked ever since, right through to the present catastrophe in Iraq.
You talk about the disastrous rise of American power. Talk about the trajectory from then to now.
Well, disastrous rise is a phrase. It's a polemical phrase. I acknowledge that. It's a phrase, though, that I get from Eisenhower in his famous military-industrial complex speech. He was, of course, talking about the military-industrial, political, academic, economic complex, labor. All of the great pillars of American life were recruited into, conscripted, you could say, into the power of this military machine centered in the Pentagon. At the crucial turning points of American history since World War II, again and again, decisions have been made all too easily in favor of war and against creating structures of peace. It happened at the end of the war with the decision, the unnecessary decision to use the atomic bomb. It happened immediately after the war with the unnecessary militarization of the contest with the Soviet Union,
and so forth.
At each of these crucial points, America misperceived the world and made decisions to protect against a threat that was more imagined than real.
Why do you feel it wasn't necessary to drop the atomic bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki?
Well, it goes, obviously, it's a complicated question about which historians are still in argument. My conclusion is that the issue of unconditional surrender was the blinder that prevented American leaders at that crucial moment of fully taking in the messages they were getting from Japan. Japan was all but defeated in the spring of 1945. We had savaged 60 Japanese cities with firebombing. There were signals from the Japanese that they wanted to surrender, and we were willfully blocked in taking those signals in, especially under the leadership of Secretary of State Burns. And the irony is that we reasserted our demand for unconditional surrender at the crucial point, the Potsdam Declaration at the end of July, yet again saying unconditional surrender. All the Japanese wanted by then was assurances about the emperor. which we refused to give them. When the Japanese did surrender after Nagasaki, they still didn't surrender unconditionally. They included a condition about the emperor, which at that point we accepted. My conclusion is, if we had accepted the condition on the emperor was a divine being to the Japanese. They couldn't tolerate the thought that what happened to Mussolini and Hitler would happen to him. If we had accepted that condition ahead of the atomic bombings, there would have been no need for those bombings. That's the conclusion I came to.
We're talking to James Carroll. He is the author of House of War, The Pentagon, and the Disastrous Rise of American Power. James, you talk about other September 11ths.
Well, yes. One of the things we love about history is the way in which one event takes on new meaning when understood in the context of another event. And I was struck, not in a mystical way particularly, but I was struck by the coincidence that the building itself, the Pentagon, the ground was broken for it in a ceremony on the morning of September 11, 1941, 60 years, perhaps almost to the minute, before the building was hit by that hijacked airplane. Once my attention was drawn to that date, I began to notice others. On September 11th in 1945, Secretary of War Henry Stimson, who had just presided over the military victory over the Germany and Japan, and who had also presided over the creation of the atomic bomb, proposed after Nagasaki to President Truman that the United States, in order to, as he put it, head off a an armament race of a rather desperate character, his phrase, should share the atomic bomb with the Soviet Union and enter into an international agreement for its control. And Truman took that memo, that recommendation from Stimson, seriously enough to make it the subject of a full cabinet meeting. A majority of the cabinet officers thought it was a good idea. The person who carried the day in the argument was the Secretary of the Navy, James Forrestal, whose paranoia about the Soviet Union soon enough showed itself to be rooted in his personal paranoia. Forrestal, the first Secretary of Defense, the man who did more to shape the American attitude toward the Soviet Union after World War II than any other single person, wound up tragically a suicide in 1949. Well, his suicide should have been a revelation of something to the American people, that the perceptions we had put in place by then about this world enemy that threatened us so grievously that we had to then be prepared over the few coming decades to oppose it in every way, including with the creation of a massive, disastrously overlarge nuclear arsenal, that all of that began in an act of political paranoia that was rooted tragically in a personal paranoia of the man who was in charge of it.
And so the majority of the cabinet agreed that the nuclear weapons, so-called secret, should be shared with the Russians.
Yes, that some arrangement should, that we should go to the Soviet Union immediately proposing some arrangement of joint control, joint renunciation. We will together renounce the development of this weapon, and we'll, and the only way that would work is if there was serious structures of joint control. It's a second question whether Stalin and the Soviets would have accepted such a thing, but it says everything about the fact that we weren't prepared to even seriously attempt it. The Baruch plan that was developed later that year was not an authentic attempt to enter into an agreement like that with the Soviet Union, because it was never serious about surrendering American sovereignty over the bomb, and it looked always to maintain the monopoly. So, and I would just point out that one of the most important supporters of the Stimson proposal on September 11th, 1945, was Dean Acheson, who was the Undersecretary of State. Acheson, at that point, was a man who was prepared to trust the Soviet Union to some extent. The significance, of course, is that his conversion to becoming the most suspicious hawk in the cabinet by the onset of the Korean War is really tells the story of the turn in American consciousness that took place there. And in House of War, I'm trying to understand how what was put in motion in these crucial post-war moments continued through the Cold War and actually have continued until today.
As you talk about those who promoted war, promoted peace, I wanted to talk about a figure who you honored recently, William Sloan Coffin, the legendary anti-war priest who died last month at the age of 81. You gave the eulogy at his funeral. Let's take a listen to a clip.
What made Bill Coffin famous was his rhetorical flair. His genius for the energetic soundbite was the solution to every reporter's deadline problem. It is not enough to pray for peace, work for justice. War is a coward's escape from the problems of peace. We must be governed by the force of law, not by the law of force. Do you see what is going on here? This is the rhetoric of irony, a bringing together of polarities to see how the tensions of life can be brought to resolution. Irony of this sort is the essence of humor, which is why we remember above all Bill's laughter. Irony depends on an exquisite balance of language and ideas both. Opposites held in tension with each other, not to split them apart, that is sarcasm, but to promise a new kind of unity.
James Carroll at the funeral of William Sloan Coffin. Further thoughts?
Well, Bill was so important to so many of us. What I remember most powerfully about him myself was I found myself in a jail cell adjacent to him once in Washington, D.C.
Protesting what?
We were arrested at the U.S. Capitol for refusing to leave the Capitol after a demand that congressmen cut off appropriations for the war in Vietnam. I was a very timid participant in war protests, a few of them. Bill was bold. He was a source of strength for people like me. And I remember through the night his singing great stretches of Handel's Messiah, especially the Alleluia chorus, as a source of tremendous strength.
Jim Carroll, speaking of peace activists, tomorrow night, while we're both in Boston here, we'll both be back in New York, and you'll be at the Salinger O'Reilly Gallery at 79th and Madison with Father Dan Berrigan, who yesterday celebrated his 85th birthday. There's going to be a big event for him on June 10th. But tomorrow night, you'll be with him, and you write about the Berrigan brothers in House of War.
Well, I was a Catholic priest as a young man, and Dan Berrigan and Phil Berrigan gave me my image of what the priesthood could be, and I would say should be. Dan and I didn't know each other in October of 1967, but we were both together at the demonstration at the Pentagon, and that was the first time Dan Berrigan was arrested, and that was the beginning of an exemplary and I would say heroic life of resistance to war. Dan Berrigan and his brother Phil changed the meaning of Roman Catholic belief for a whole generation of us Catholics, and he also had that tremendous impact on American culture generally. And of course, the most important thing about Dan and Phil is they didn't stop after the war in Vietnam stopped. They didn't forget that America is still a nation at the mercy of the war impulse, and Phil and Dan have been witnesses for peace all these many years.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, and we'll be speaking again soon. We hardly touched House of War. That's James Carroll's new book, House of War, The Pentagon and the Disastrous Rise of American Power, as he begins after this program his trip across country to talk about the book and the state of the country and the world today. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, we stay here in Boston because there's a controversy brewing at Boston College over honoring the Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice. Stay with us.
Oh, and only a layman's batch of napalm. We pulled the draft files out. We burned them in the parking lot. Better the files that drop their bombs right where my government knew I would be. I had no right for the love of you. I had no right for the love of you. And all my country saw were priests who broke the law. First it was a question, then it was a mission. How to be American, how to be a Christian. Oh, if the law is their cross and the cross is burning.
I Have No Right, Dar Williams, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We are broadcasting from Boston, Massachusetts. Last week, Boston College announced Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice would be speaking at this year's commencement ceremony on May 22nd, where she'd be receiving an honorary law degree. Soon after the announcement, two top theologians at the college circulated a letter of opposition among the faculty. As of yesterday, 200 faculty members signed the letter. More than 1,000 members of the Boston College community have signed a petition opposing the awarding of the honorary degree to Secretary Rice. An ad hoc faculty group has also sent a letter to Boston College asking them to rescind the honor. It reads in part, "The honorary doctorate of laws is one of the university's highest honors to be bestowed upon individuals worthy of such recognition as a result of highly admirable accomplishments in their personal and professional lives. We believe Secretary Rice does not deserve this honor, and to the extent that this degree is presumed to be conferred by the faculty, it is a compromised honor. Although Secretary Rice's personal biography and scholarly performance are noteworthy indeed, her decisions as National Security Advisor and Secretary of State discredit these achievements. Her statements and actions contradict Jesuit values and teachings on the ethics of war and violence against persons." That was an excerpt of the letter. We go now to a debate on the issue. We're joined by Juliet Shore in studio here in Boston. She is the head of the faculty group that drafted the letter. Juliet Shore is a professor of sociology at Boston College, author of a number of books. Her latest is Born to Buy, The Commercialized Child and the New Consumer Culture, also author of Overworked American, The Unexpected Decline of Leisure, as well as The Overspent American, Upscaling, Downshifting, and The New Consumer. We're joined on the telephone by Mark Landy. He's professor in the political science department at Boston College and co-author of the textbook American Government, Balancing Democracy and Rights. We also asked a representative of Boston College to be on the program, but they did not get back to us. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! I want to begin with Mark Landy. Why do you support this decision, the honoring of Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice with an honorary degree?
Well, let's start with the most elementary point. She is the Secretary of State of the United States. As members of that community, that political community, it seems to me almost commonsensical that if the second in my presidency course, I talk about the Secretary of State as the second most important office in the land. Secretary Rice is the Secretary of State. She, even as that letter suggests, she's a person of extraordinary personal qualities on top of her high office. So of course she should get this sort of recognition. We've given it to people far less worthy than her.
Juliet, sure.
I think holding office in the minds of many at Boston College is not sufficient criterion for being honored in this way. And we got to look at what the person in office is doing. There are people who hold high government offices all around the world who are not worthy of being honored. Boston College is a values-driven institution. That's the core of its mission, and it's the way it advertises itself to the world. This was an opportunistic choice, a kind of let's get some star power, even if this person is involved in activities which are not only unworthy of being honored, but are illegal and immoral. I mean, this is a person who, not too many years from now, we may be seeing in front of a war crimes tribunal.
Mark Lande.
We didn't pick a rock star. This woman does not just have star power. She is the representative of a great country. And whereas Juliet or anybody else can be very free to criticize her views and her policies, the idea that she belongs in front of a war tribunal is not something I can dignify with a response. Ms. Rice presides over a wide range of choices, a wide range of policies. She's handled that vast duty with dignity, with honor, and I'm perfectly prepared to have a debate about the war in Iraq and the war on terror, but the idea that you can trivialize this person or demonize her, as I'm hearing, simply is not on the table.
Professor Juliet Shore.
It's not trivializing or demonizing. It's just speaking to the facts. I mean, this is an illegal war. It is an immoral war. This week, the same week that the university made this announcement, the U.S. government was defending itself at a U.N. commission on torture and very much on the defensive. A major report was presented at that commission showing that the U.S. is involved in widespread, and that's a quote, torture at U.S.-run detention centers all over the world. Evidence emerging about extraordinary renditions, 1,000 rendition flights now, is the number that people are talking about. So this is very serious business. There is a whole worldwide community out there which is, many of whom are taking the point of view that the U.S. is involved in war crimes. And as the university's announcement about this honorary degree recipient notes, first sentence, she is the major architect of U.S. foreign policy. It's not trivial at all, Mark.
Professor Lande.
It's more demonic than trivial. When I responded to the first draft of the letter that I saw, I called it grotesque. And let me see if I can't explain that. It's grotesque because it truly distorts our moral compass. The idea that the United States can be castigated in the way that Juliet tries to do it, and covering it with the veneer of the UN does not get us away from the basic fact. There's a war on terror going on. We're faced with responding to groups that have already killed thousands. Saddam killed hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands. U.S. has done things that I'm not proud of, but to try to put our errors and our problems that we have actually prosecuted people for in the same moral dimension as the mass graves of Saddam Hussein, the slaughter of the Kurds, the Holocaust against the Shiites, is in fact a grotesque distortion.
Well, Mark, we can, we in the United States deal with what our government is doing. I consider myself, as a U.S. citizen, my highest priority is to deal with the actions of the United States government. So that's what I'm focusing on. And there are tens of thousands of people who have been killed in this war. There are already commissions going around this country talking about war crimes. We are using depleted uranium in this war. We are involved in a widespread network of torture. And whether or not other people are torturing more persons or killing more persons is really beside the point. In some sense, it doesn't minimize what our government is doing. I mean, that's just, we as U.S. citizens have a responsibility to deal with what is being done in our name.
We as U.S. citizens have responsibility to take the world in its real dimension and to recognize the magnitude of the dangers we face, to recognize that these examples, which I see no evidence are widespread, just because this commission or that commission is formed, Juliet and I can form a commission tomorrow. The fact remains that you cannot put the sins of the United States and the sins of our adversaries in the same moral category. This is a moral distortion. It prevents us from seeing the world clearly and making the very difficult decisions that we have to make.
Well, there we have a very fundamental disagreement, Mark, starting from Hiroshima and Nagasaki to the Vietnam War to the overthrow of a long list of democratically elected governments to the current wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. We just disagree very fundamentally about the nature and scope of U.S. Foreign policy and military policy, particularly in the last 50 years. So we can agree to disagree on that. I think that's obviously the backdrop here, because the primary objection of faculty to the choice of Secretary Rice is on the policies that she and this administration are carrying out. I would say a secondary dimension of this is that this is a highly politicized choice. We have a singularly unpopular administration with an extremely unpopular war. They took us to war on the basis of deceptions and distortions. Her own words and activity around selling the war were particularly salient in this regard. And this choice has plunged our community into tremendous divisiveness. I mean, we stand on the corridor normally together and talk in a happy way, and here we are, at odds with each other on national media. And so I think that's testament to the fact that this choice was a gross miscalculation and took away from commencement the character that it should have, which is a happy, celebratory day, not one in which our community is at odds with each other, but one in which we should all be focusing on the accomplishments of our graduates happily together.
I totally look forward to chatting with Juliet again in the corridor in a cheerful way, but she puts the shoe on the wrong foot. The reason that this has become a contentious issue is because a certain element of the BC community, and by the way, I haven't seen the names. I hear 200. I'd like to know if these are 200 signatories from the regular faculty. I look forward to seeing the names.
But my point is. Yes, as far as I know, they are. The letter went only out to the faculty list. Well, of course, the petitions that are online have, anyone can sign those, and those are a combination.
Right. My serious point is that the politicization is done by the enemies of Secretary Rice, not by the invitation. It's not in opportunistic to invite the second most powerful person in the government. And
on that note, we're going to have to leave it there because we've come to the end of the program. Mark Lande, professor of political science, Juliet Shore, professor of sociology at Boston College, debating the honoring of Condoleezza Rice at the college graduation in just a few days. We're here in Boston. I look forward to seeing people at the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library today at 10 o'clock in the morning for the Elizabeth Neufer Forum on Human Rights and Journalism, honoring the reporter, Elizabeth Neufer of Boston Globe, who died in Iraq a few years ago. That does it for the show. Democracy Now! Produced by Sharif Abdelkaddous, Mike Burke, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Frank Lopez, Jen Utes. Special thanks to Dennis Moynihan, Uri Galed. I'm Amy Goodman. Our website is democracynow.org. Thanks so much for joining us.